content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first story today is entitled, Why Do Rich Kids Love Socialism? Written by Tyler Austin Harper. When the news broke that a co-chair of New York City's Democratic Socialists of America chapter lives in a $1.5 million Brooklyn townhouse paid for by his father, critics of the DSA had a field day. The New York Post jabbed at Gustavo Gordillo, a 38-year-old former Yale student, for benefiting from his dad's largesse while railing against the rich and property ownership. The condemnation got even louder when the Post reported that Gordillo had dropped out of an electrician apprenticeship and never became fully credentialed. So, this commie failed out of his apprentice program for not doing the work required. Katie Pavlik, a host for Cable's News Nation, wrote on X, Gordillo told me that leaving his electrician training was a difficult choice that he'd made so he could devote more time to his DSA role. Gordillo is only the most recent prominent leftist to be accused of being a silver-spooned elite masquerading as a working-class radical. Until Graham Platner's Maine Senate campaign exploded in disgrace, Platner was routinely cast as a son of privilege, playing Carhartt dress-up. His grandfather was a famous architect and interior designer. His mom's restaurant was his oyster farm's primary customer, and his dad helped set him up with a house. Excuse my hiccup there. And his dad helped set him up with a house, just as Gordillo's father did. Zoran Mondani was likewise criticized during his mayoral run for being a socialist, despite having been born to Hollywood film-producing, Ugandan villa-owning parents. These charges of hypocrisy have only gotten louder as DSA candidates have won a string of Democratic primaries across the country. Conservative and moderate organs of opinion have described these progressive successes as being driven by white, wealthy, college-educated youngsters. This observation/accusation is substantiated by both national polling and the DSA's most recent membership survey, which found at least 77% of members were white, and that more than 80% of members 25 years or older held at least an undergraduate degree. If the Democrats are having a Tea Party moment, as the New York Times recently suggested, it is a revolution powered largely by disaffected, college-educated people, many of whom are comparatively well off. The New Yorker's Jay Caspian Kang, with whom I co-host a podcast, has called these voters Subaru socialists, degree holders who have enough money to afford, say, mid-level cars and meals at nice restaurants, but who may not own a home or feel fully secure. Republican Senator John Kennedy prefers the more biting moniker Lululemons. These aspersions cast at socialists such as Gordillo, who champion radical politics in public while contributing to the gentrification of Brooklyn in private, and whose commitments to being working class seem dubious, are understandable and often amusing. But focusing on the many contradictions, of rich kid leftists is also a way of ignoring a more interesting, potentially more illuminating question. Why are so many privileged Americans drawn to politics that seeks to dismantle the system that they have benefited from? In a 1977 essay for the magazine Radical America, Barbara and John Ehrenreich coined a term for America's growing population of college-educated knowledge workers, the, quote, professional managerial class, or PMC. The authors noted that the members of the PMC tend to have jobs that create and maintain capitalist culture and its associated values. They have jobs in industries such as the arts, education, medicine, entertainment, law, advertising, and technology that could be seen as offering proof of capitalism's ability to provide Americans with lives that are culturally rich, physically healthy, intellectually stimulating, and filled with technologies that make things easier. Being a staff writer at The Atlantic is a great example of one such job. According to the Ehrenreichs, the 20th century professional class played a crucial role implicitly and sometimes explicitly in maintaining the public's faith in the economic system. The present growing embrace of leftist politics among the professional class suggests that the PMC is no longer especially enthusiastic about that mission. A CBS News YouGov poll released this month found that Democrats, who belong to a party dominated by the professional class, were almost twice as likely to view socialism favorably as they were to view capitalism favorably. Among college-educated Democrats, support for socialism was 71%. This is not entirely new. In 1977, the Ehrenreichs noted that radicalism and even anti-capitalism could be found among certain educated professionals, particularly those in academia. But the PMC's current tilt toward the left is unprecedented in American history. Throughout the mid-2000s, college-educated voters were more likely to be Republicans than Democrats. Bachelor's degree holders broke for Reagan in 1984 at a margin that was higher than 2-1. What is notable about the 20th century professional managerial class, then, is that the type of people who are tasked with championing capitalism to the public have lost their faith. Many members of today's professional class are apostates, and this apostasy is worth taking seriously as a sign of an economic order that cannot seem to justify itself to its own public relations arm. When a middle manager at a tobacco company refuses to smoke cigarettes, or a technology CEO sends his children to screen-free schools, or an employee in a meatpacking industry turns vegetarian, many people understand these choices to be the result of not only of hypocrisy, but also insider insight. According to its own demographic survey, the DSA is filled with people who are employed in or training for traditional PMC labor, teachers and professors, social workers, healthcare professionals, government employees. That some people in these industries, including those who are well paid, would look at our economy and seek out other ways of doing things is neither hypocritical or surprising. A teacher who has to buy his own school supplies, an adjunct professor who works at three universities to make ends meet, a social worker who assists the disadvantaged, a nurse whose hospital was bought by private equity, a federal employee who watches lobbying groups kneecap safety regulations, a data engineer who helps make a product that gives teens suicide advice, a student who takes out burdensome loans to get a degree that is no longer a guaranteed ticket to a middle-class life. What should these people think of capitalism as it currently exists? What do you expect them to think? And why is it considered hypocrisy rather than a defensible moral position when some members of the PMC decide that the ugliness they encounter in their workplace, corporate office, and daily life is symptomatic of a system that deserves significant, even systemic, reform? Some Subaru socialists, of course, might be drawn to the progressive political movements because that's what their friends are doing, or because they are bored with their own privilege. But many professional class socialists are no doubt making an earnest moral judgment, born of first-hand experience, that contemporary capitalism is deeply flawed. Explaining his own reasoning for being part of the DSA, Gordillo told me in a text, "I have experienced economic life in this country from many different vantages, so I know that it is often luck that determines whether someone has financial stability. This is wrong." A political lesson could be learned from Mamdani, who, with his smart suits and easy eloquence, makes no effort to hide his social position or fancy liberal arts degree. Rather than elevating leaders who pretend to be working class, socialists and left-leaning populists might be better off unapologetically presenting themselves as what many of them are: worried, frustrated, and often justifiably angry members of the educated professional class. Today's second story, An American City with Troops on Its Streets, written by Quinta Jurekic and Marie-Rose Scheinerman. The sight of military troops patrolling in a peaceful American city would once have been strange, if not outright alarming. But since last August, when Donald Trump first deployed the National Guard to Washington, D.C., residents have become accustomed to seeing men and women in camouflage military fatigues on duty throughout the city and its public transit system. Sometimes they trail federal officers from agencies such as the FBI and U.S. Marshals Service, dispatched by Trump to patrol the district in bulletproof vests. More often, the troops wander around unaccompanied in small groups. D.C. has now entered its second year with federal troops on its streets. President Trump initially ordered the Guard into the capital city, sent federal agents to work as beat cops, and briefly seized control of D.C.'s local police department following the attempted carjacking of a former member of Elon Musk's Doge team. The early days of a D.C. safe and beautiful task force produced dramatic headlines. As the year dragged on, though, its activities faded from national news coverage, even as armed troops and federal agents continued to patrol. The Pentagon says it plans to keep the Guard in D.C. through January of 2029, which will cost taxpayers more than $1 billion. For all that money, the Guard's purpose here is largely inscrutable. They don't bother nobody. They just go back and forth and back and forth. Andrea Pulliam, a Washington Metropolitan Area Transit Authority employee at the DuPont Circle Metro stop, told us. Occasionally, Pulliam said, she has seen guards help a rider who's super drunk or check out an abandoned backpack. But most of the time, a station manager, Deidre Foster, told us, it seems like they're really bored. Whereas other American cities targeted by Trump with National Guard deployments found success in court, D.C.'s lack of statehood limits its ability to fight back. The presence of the task force represents a particularly Trump-era indignity for the city, both comic and menacing, abusive and ineffective, appalling to some, and as time goes on, exhaustingly commonplace. Anti-democratic throughout the federal takeover, though the federal takeover may be, D.C. residents have been forced to live with it. At first, the 800 or so troops called up were locals, members of the D.C. National Guard, which, unlike other state and territorial guard units, is under the president's direct control. Then governors from around the country, mostly Republicans, began volunteering their own troops. The total headcount was about 2,000 before ballooning to 5,000 before the America 250 celebrations, enough that in some neighborhoods, walking to the metro or picking up groceries without encountering guardsmen became nearly impossible. The Trump administration has promoted the Guard's presence as an overwhelming success. Washington, D.C. went from high crime to no crime. Thank you, President Trump, the president posted on Truth Social in early July. This month, Trump claimed that the crime in the city had dropped 92%, citing a favorite number of his. True, crime has largely fallen in the capital over the past year, but it was on the decline before Trump's surge, and cities across the country without any comparable federal presence have seen similar positive trends. Numbers reported by D.C.'s Metropolitan Police Department suggest that violent crime in the district may, in fact, be slightly up. A recent report by the Moderate Niskanen Center found that the deployment of the National Guard led to a roughly 25% decrease in petty property crime over the first 6 months, but had, quote, no measurable effect on violent crime, end quote. Another analysis published by the left-leaning Center for American Progress reported strong evidence that the deployment of the National Guard did not result in a measurable decrease in violent crime rates. In response, Trump threatened to sue the organization. The National Guard may have not done much in part because there isn't much for them to do. Troops have been sworn in as deputy U.S. Marshals, which gives them some powers of law enforcement, but the terms of their appointments state that they cannot independently conduct searches or make arrests. They can, however, detain suspected lawbreakers until either local or federal law enforcement arrives. According to a recent analysis of court records by Reuters, troops have been mentioned in only 1.3% of criminal cases prosecuted in D.C. Superior Court over the past year, and in some of those cases, they were the victims. The media relations page for the Guard's D.C. presence includes stories about picking up trash and reuniting a lost boy with his parents on the National Mall. Perhaps most notable, the Guard has been carrying the overdose prevention drug naloxone, commonly known by its brand name Narcan. Earlier this month, the D.C. National Guard's interim commanding general told reporters that guardsmen had administered the drug 325 times. Sergeant Hare, a guardsman outside the Woodley Park metro station, who declined to give his first name, citing National Guard policies, told us that he had lost track of how many drug-related emergencies he'd helped with, but said it was the main thing he'd done during his deployment. Could this be handled without having the National Guard in D.C.? Probably, Regina LaBelle, an addiction policy professor at Georgetown University, told us. But since they are here, she said, it's really good that they are using naloxone where it's needed. Whatever the troops are or aren't doing, their presence is a reminder of Trump's power to shape the world as he alone pleases. America's founders understood domestic deployment of the military as a tool of a tyrant and put in place legal protections against it, protections that Trump has now set about eroding. The president treats America's cities as though they're populated by scofflaws to be subjugated rather than by citizens with a say in their own future. And deploying the Guard to D.C. is a way to make that vision into a reality. They're an armed occupying force in our city, Marawi Garima, an organizer of the D.C. Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression, told us. Garima and other activists we spoke with emphasized that they understood the Guard's deployment as only one aspect of the larger federal presence in D.C. As part of the D.C. Safe and Beautiful Task Force, federal agents have been reassigned from their normal responsibilities to act as beat cops, dispatched from agencies such as the FBI, the Drug Enforcement Administration, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives, Customs and Border Protection, the Secret Service, the Park Police, the U.S. Marshals Service, and Diplomatic Security Service, and, oddly, the IRS. Although Guard troops are a visual signature of Trump's seizure of control over the city, they compromise the least energetic component of the task force. The federal law enforcement officers deployed across D.C. at Trump's directive have been far busier and more aggressive. Twice this past fall, agents with ICE's Homeland Security Investigations Division fired their weapons during traffic stops. Months later, a deputy U.S. Marshal shot and killed a robbery suspect. After the administration lifted restrictions on car chases by park police, the agency launched a flurry of high-speed chases. Multiple crashes and at least two deaths of a bystander and a fleeing driver soon followed. During the first 6 months of the surge, immigration enforcement and other federal agents roamed the city, detaining residents off the street. ICE has been less prominent since December, when a D.C. federal court enjoined the government from carrying out mass immigration arrests without a warrant. But Sandra Benevente, the advocacy manager at the immigration aid nonprofit IUTA, told us that immigrant communities still feel the aftershocks of those arrests. "We've seen since last summer this climate of fear around all uniformed law enforcement," she said, "including the National Guard. Some of the group's clients, including those relying on IUTA for food or assistance with seeking legal status, have missed appointments because they are afraid of being stopped on their way downtown." Although ICE activity remains limited in D.C., other federal agencies continue to police the city in unprecedented numbers, sometimes alongside officers with D.C.'s local Metropolitan Police Department. The lockup list in D.C. Superior Court, which records people detained overnight by law enforcement for arraignment the next business day, routinely hovers near 100, far greater than the pre-surge norm of 60 or so. "There's a difference in the intensity of the policing," Garima said, "particularly in black and brown neighborhoods. All three of the men shot at by task force members, including the person who died, were black." The additional federal presence provides law enforcement with more resources, he said, and what they're using that to do is to grab anybody for anything, any semblance of a crime. Minor violations of the local laws that might previously have brought about nothing more than a ticket, such as drinking from an open container, are now resulting in arrests by federal agents. Even in the National Guard's D.C. deployment, especially after Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth ordered the troops to begin carrying firearms, some residents worried about potential violence. So far, the troops deployed to the Capitol have not been responsible for any civilian deaths, the bare minimum of what one might hope from a military deployment on U.S. soil. In fact, the only bloodshed related to the Guard involved troops as victims, when an Afghan man who had served with U.S. Special Forces in Afghanistan shot two members of the West Virginia Guard near the White House, one of whom later died. Apart from this burst of violence, the troops' stay in the Capitol has thus far been largely peaceful, albeit the ominous sort of peace that results from uniformed men and women strolling around with guns. In one notable exception, partially caught on video, three troops were physically aggressive in detaining a woman outside her home, pushing her to the ground and zip-tying her hands so tightly that, she later wrote in a claim against the Guard, the plastic cuffs ruptured one or more ligaments in her wrist, requiring surgery. The National Guard says that the woman, Anna King, had thrown unknown liquid at other Guard members. Prosecutors brought assault charges against King for the liquid incident and for allegedly harming a member of the Guard while being detained. She has posted not guilty. Trump's America is a land of perpetual indignation, where scandals that might once have ended a presidency have become commonplace. After a year of federal presence, D.C. is suspended somewhere between the routine and the outrageous. Still, activists we spoke with described continued energy to fight Trump's overreach. Some organize protests, others quietly keep tabs on federal agents in their neighborhoods. The protest group Free DC, which has grown prominent over the past year, encourages residents to voice their complaints by writing to governors who have sent their National Guard troops to the city. "I feel like it's just better for me to ignore them," Jill Robinson, a health educator who has lived in the area for 4 decades, told us, "yet I feel angry and annoyed." Robinson was attending a Free DC event, one of nearly a dozen planned by the group in the days leading up to August 11th, the first anniversary of the National Guard deployment. She had attended previous Free DC training sessions, including how to stay safe if law enforcement becomes aggressive at a protest. This event was meant to honor Norberto Meza, the bystander who was struck and killed by in Northwest DC during a park police chase of a suspended stolen car. Amid torrents of summer rain, several dozen people had gathered on the bridge where Meza was hit, wearing ponchos, clutching umbrellas, and carrying signs with slogans such as "End the Occupation." The attendees included more seasoned protesters like Robinson, but also newcomers such as Ella and Aunt Peels, who had moved to Washington in May from Annapolis, Maryland. They'd read about the deployment before their move, but seeing the guardsmen out and about, maybe three times every week we take a walk, had made them uncomfortable. "It definitely gives an eerie feeling to living here," Ella said. "It doesn't make me feel safe." The troops and federal agents are here without the city's say, at the pleasure of one man only, and there is little the city can do about it. The legal restraints on D.C. are unique, but the city is not going through this experience entirely alone. To the southwest, Memphis had a similar federal presence, along with a deployment of hundreds of Tennessee National Guard troops sent by the state's Republican governor. Trump announced the Memphis Safe Task Force a month after the D.C. Task Force began its surge, touting Memphis as, quote, "a replica of our extraordinarily successful efforts," end quote, in D.C. Now both, the Guard and a contingent of federal agents have patrolled Memphis for almost a year. In four separate incidents, city residents died after being shot by members of the task force. Two National Guard troops were responsible for one shooting. The agents in the other three incidents were with the DEA and ICE's Homeland Security Investigation Division. In both Memphis and D.C., people harmed by the task force have limited options for legal redress. Although federal civil rights law allows lawsuits against state and local officials for violations of constitutional rights, options for suing federal officers are far more limited. In one case, the ACLU is pushing for accountability after MPD, called in by an Ohio National Guard sergeant, handcuffed and detained a D.C. resident who had been protesting the Guard by trailing troops while blasting the Imperial March from Star Wars on his phone. D.C. settled, but litigation continues against the sergeant, who argues he was acting in a federal role. The activists we spoke with said they see their push to rid D.C. of this military presence as part of a larger effort to oppose authoritarian overreach. The Imperial March case makes the metaphor for them. It is absurd, a Star Wars joke that ended with someone in handcuffs, but also unnerving. In a city or country with fewer and fewer checks on presidential authority, a small act of dissent can provoke a big abuse of power. We're out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Please join us next time. We hope you've enjoyed listening. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.